July 26th will be the 28th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act. Disability activist and writer Mary Johnson wrote for FAIR about the historic 1990 signing on the White House lawn. At that point, and maybe still, the largest gathering ever of journalists for a disability story. And while celebration was in order, it was hard not to notice the shallowness of some press coverage. One story noted an empty wheelchair and suggested that the occupant might have gotten up and walked on the waves of emotion. And only a single wire piece pointed out that the White House itself lacked the accessible bathrooms that the ADA mandated. Media do tend to cover the ADA anniversary, but that reporting often takes a boring, we've come a long way, there's a long way to go tone that implies that full human rights for people with disabilities are something less than urgent, and that present the disability community as sort of waiting and hoping for acknowledgement and inclusion. The disability community has always been more complicated, more diverse, more active, and more engaged than elite media suggest. And elections are chances to see evidence of that. Our next guest is Andrew Pulrang. He's co-founder, along with Greg Barrington and Alice Wong, of the Crip the Vote campaign. He also blogs at disabilitythinking.com. He joins us now by phone from Plattsburgh, New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Andrew Pulrang.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with the ADA. It did shift the terms from accommodation of people with disabilities in the workforce, in public space, to a civil rights kind of framing, you know, that it's not noblesse oblige. This is a legal right to access and to opportunity. And I wouldn't want to underestimate the value of simply declaring that. But I wonder, 28 years on, how would you assess the ADA's actual impact? Do we see the spirit and the letter of the law being lived out, do you think?
It's just not an easy question to answer.
Yeah.
And you really can't get around the fact that it depends on what one was expecting from the law to begin with. So, yes, we expected all new buildings to be fully accessible. We expected buildings that were renovated to always have the renovated portions be accessible. And we expected existing buildings that were kind of old to get gradually more accessible in a steady sort of way. We expected transportation to all be accessible, up to including buses and trains and all that kind of stuff. But I think we really expected a lot better employment situations. And anyway, overall, I think that the results have been mixed. That's being kind of charitable. As you pointed out, disability issues do tend to be put on a back burner. Not that they are not important or that people don't acknowledge in the abstract that they might be important, but they just don't ever seem to get to the top of the list. And that includes the top of the list for businesses that are going to open a new store and that type of thing.
I remember very well doing a story about Clint Eastwood at the time, who had a restaurant, I guess, that was inaccessible and had been sued. And his response, I thought, was representative in some ways of a certain kind of attitude, which was, why didn't they just ask me?
Well, that's the premise behind, I think it's H.R. 620, the bill in Congress that would actually amend the Americans with Disabilities Act so that you would have to, in some fashion, directly inform somebody before suing them for violation of the ADA, which to a lot of people, maybe most people, sounds like common sense. And in fact, I would say it's what most people do. Most people do not just out of the air one day visit a place, see it's not accessible, and file a lawsuit.
Right.
That's a really hard thing to do. And it's not lucrative for the most part. It's expensive. So most people do, if they do anything at all, they do go and say, hey, your place is inaccessible, and can we fix that? So Clint Eastwood's problem back then and the problems that are cited now, I think you can find anecdotal cases where maybe, you know, you would have done it differently and maybe a place was sort of blindsided or whatever. But I think that's been blown way out of proportion for a political purpose, which is to basically take anything left of the ADA out of it for businesses, essentially.
Right. I just think when people think about it a little deeper, they might wonder why someone would have to make a complaint or make a lawsuit or any of that in order to simply have access to things that folks expect to have access to. You know, the idea that you should simply accept that you're a second-class citizen, you know, and that your polling place might not be accessible, you know. And, you know, right. I just think it's a framing question in terms of just the way we think of it. And I have to confess, mm-hmm. I am never not surprised. I am never not surprised at the willingness of not just media, but many people to sort of think, well, that's terrible, but you know, it's not a rights kind of conversation that we tend to have.
The last few years at the anniversary, we are constantly pointing out, you know, now it's going to be 28 years, and the thing is, we've been hearing essentially the same story in some vague form for 28 years, which is that. It's not always explicit, but the implication that, oh, these are a bunch of new requirements and it's going to take time. Well, you know, I would accept even 10 years ago, right? I would even accept that that is in some sense new in the grand historical span of the way people have been building buildings. But 28 years is long enough for people to figure this stuff out. And that includes buildings that in 1990 were already existing. That includes old downtowns with, you know, two steps up to the old store or soda shop or whatever. What we see most in the way of barriers is not so much, you know, unfortunately, not so much, you know, your strip malls and, you know, big shopping centers, but your downtowns, you know, they have their own problems trying to struggle. But they all had steps in front of them because they were all built in the 1890s. But it's been 28 years. There are solutions to these things. I think with the exception of the people who really did their jobs and code enforcement officials who really did their jobs, which they do not always do, most other people kind of put it on the back burner. They kind of know what the ADA is, but they think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. It's just too expensive to, you know, get a better place or put a ramp in or what have you, and I'm just going to wait until somebody complains.
When we think about how to respond to that, when we think about societal solutions to push people to make changes without an individual, you know, coming up and asking them, well, we think about the electoral process and the political process. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to Crypt the Vote. It's an online campaign. It's a kind of space, really, as I understand it, for a conversation. And it started with you and Alice Wong and Greg Barrettin watching the presidential debates back in 2015 and noting the, as Greg called it, the loud silence around issues mm-hmm. affecting people with disabilities. How has Crypt the Vote grown since then? What is its role now going forward into these new elections?
Well, it's really evolved. We started out just live tweeting the debates because the three of us, Greg, Alice, and myself, were just saying, well, you know, once again, we're probably not going to hear anything, or will we hear anything that even remotely we could relate to as far as disability? And that developed into saying, well, why just the debates? Why don't we have chats on specific topics where we say, okay, at a certain date and time, we're going to have an hour-long discussion on Twitter. And the way it all ties together is through the hashtag, Crypt the Vote. And that's not just a slogan. It's an actual mechanism to follow the conversation. So we started having scheduled chats. We put out questions beforehand so that people could, you know, see what it was going to be about first and prepare some answers, because people have a hard time sometimes keeping up with Twitter. We also did a online survey, not scientific, but just of our little community, of what issues do we care about most, what are our priorities, and we kind of disseminated that. And we just continued through the conventions and right up until the election and after.
I thought your findings on that survey in terms of what leapt out for people were interesting. What did you learn there?
The one that sticks out is the top issue or the top initiative that we put on the list that got the most votes by far, or to appoint and elect more disabled people into public office. So we were thinking in those terms of, so a new president's coming in, who are you going to appoint to run agencies and help run agencies that actually pertain to our issues, and that we want to see representation, not just at the ballot box, but in office. And to me, that was the biggest surprise, because we put it in there thinking, well, let's see what people think about that. And it got the biggest vote of all.
In other words, people really actually want disabled people representing them, and not simply to add their list of concerns to a long list of other things, but to actual representation, And that's not
exactly
to say that they didn't care about other issues, but actual representation.
I think we gave them a list of 15 issues to let them choose 10. Healthcare was a big issue.
Wages, home care, services.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to just say disabled people vote. Right? This is not, I think this might be a misconception, but vote in numbers very close to average numbers nationally.
We vote less than we should, in the sense that there are fewer of us voting than are eligible.
Right.
And that's always seems to be the case. But in real numbers, it's very large. So it's a significant voting population. I mean, I remember when I first got started in disability rights back around the ADA's passage, people were already saying that an incident that happened in the early 80s regarding disability policy changed how the first President Bush dealt with disability issues. They wanted to do some regulation change regarding disability services, and the outcry was way bigger than they had imagined. Some people lay that as being one of the founding things, that why would this Republican president sign this act, even though it passed Congress. And one of them was that he, at the very least, had a respect for the power of the disability movement. And I think we've always been trying to capitalize on that. But, there's a dozen reasons why it's kind of hard to actually turn numbers into clout.
Well, and that's what Crip the Vote, one of the reasons that I appreciate it so much is that it brings together a range of things that people might not necessarily tag as disability related, but that absolutely are. And I relate it to journalism, because with any marginalized group, it's not just a matter of wanting them to do stories on the particular experiences of people with disabilities, for example, but to also locate disabled people within the stories that they are doing every day. You can read 10 stories about Social Security and not have one of them elaborate what it means for people with disabilities. It's not just, in other words, in terms of media, it's not just an overlooking of the disabled community, but I think in some cases an actual erasure of disabled people from issues that they ought to be part of.
Exactly. I mean, there's an issue going on right now that I think it's a little early to tell exactly how it's going to play out, but the issue of banning plastic straws is a very, very interesting example. As you may be aware, there's it seems to be the hot issue right now as far as grassroots environmental efforts, because it's a thing you can do locally. You can get your municipality, you can get a company to do it. Starbucks says that they're going to ban plastic straws by 2020 or something like that. But there's a significant portion of disabled folks that need plastic straws to be able to drink. The movement got quite far along before anybody took any real notice of the fact that, hey, some of us really need these things. It's just started to come out. I've seen some news stories about it in regular media that are non-specialized, that are pointing out, hey, this is a little problem here. It's an example of how our issues can be absolutely forgotten.
And that things can be so compartmentalized. And this comes back to Crip the Vote, which is an intersectional kind of conversation. I once had kind of a fight with a disability activist who I got a mailer that said essentially, black people have overcome. When is it our turn? And I thought, what if I'm black and disabled? And this can be such a difficulty, I think, for folks. You know, we're not, it's not people with disabilities versus Black people versus people who care about the environment. You know, that's where the intersectionality comes in. And Crip the Vote has made a space for, you know, thinking across difference, even within the disabled community.
We really have. And I have to say personally that that's been a growth thing for me because, you know, I do come from a tradition which tended to see disability issues. We had sort of an inferiority complex about it, which is kind of understandable because of what we've just been talking about. But one of the strategies I think has been to not ally with other people and not to let other people's, quote unquote, other people's issues get into our own, because we need to focus on disability, because people won't do that. And I think that's just a wrong strategy, for one thing. In addition to being, you know, immoral, I think it's just a flawed strategy. I think you have to ally with people, and you have to realize that groups overlap in dozens of ways. And I've been very glad that we've been able to do that to some extent, at least in Crip the Vote.
Yeah, it makes for a strength, I think, going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that you have written about is a set of issues that people might think are electoral issues, but that they might not think about as disability issues. And I just wonder, you know, what are some of the things, whether you're talking to journalists or just to regular folk, you know, what are some things that you might want to put on the radar in terms of, you know, you might not know that this engages the disability community, but it actually is critical there.
Well, okay, I'll mention, first of all, one of the issues that we were hoping to work on, you know, under slightly different circumstances, but haven't given up on it, is the subminimum wage. This is where certain subgroups of disabled folks are able to be paid, or are it's legal to pay them less than minimum wage for their work, which, you know, has been a rehabilitation strategy, I guess you could call it, since the 1930s. We feel it's long overdue to be ended. If you're going to have people with disabilities who maybe you say cannot work in a regular job, if you're going to be doing stuff to have them work in workshops or do special kinds of employment, you know, why not just pay the minimum wage? You know what I'm saying? You're already doing all this other stuff. Just go ahead and pay the minimum wage. It's become such an insult and so degrading and so unnecessary, I think, especially right now when the economy in terms of jobs is relatively good, you know, comparatively, when there are alternatives for people to go to. So we want to do that. Another issue is, you know, Medicaid and healthcare in general, but particularly right now Medicaid, because, you know, last year part of the healthcare debate was proposed massive, massive cuts to Medicaid. And a lot of people with disabilities depend on Medicaid, not just for their health care, as we tend to think of it, but for everyday personal care, just to live and function in their own homes. You know, cuts of the size that they were proposing would just not be sustainable, and we would probably lose a lot of those services. And, you know, what you kind of alluded to before, that people don't really know about them so much, is really one of our constant challenges, because let's take the healthcare debate, you know, Medicare for all is a fairly popular idea on the left. I think a lot of us share the general idea of universal health care along the lines of Medicare for all. See, I'm slipping right there.
Mm-hmm.
But for people with disabilities, frankly, we would prefer Medicaid for all, because Medicare doesn't do home care. And frankly, a lot of people you run into, I'm not going to say everybody, but a lot of people aren't really sure what's the difference between Medicaid and Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you say, well, Medicare for all, great. I know that what they're referring to is this general idea, but the details do matter. And that's frankly one of the things about disability issues that's sort of unique, is that the details always matter with our issues, whether it's the difference between Medicare and Medicaid or the difference between a half-inch step and no step at all. Those little details that everybody looks at and says, well, does it really matter? Well, it almost always really does matter for us.
We've been speaking with Andrew Polrang. He's co-founder of the Crypt the Vote campaign, and he blogs at disabilitythinking.com. Andrew Polrang, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.